Spaceship, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Good evening. For those who don't know, I'm Mark Allen, publisher of Nexus magazine. And I would say there are two types of people in the world. Those who've read Nexus and those who are about to. So welcome to those who are about to. The current issue, on sale here, special price of £4, or any four for £10. Bargain price. So Nexus does this, it reads between the lines of the things that go on. You see the sort of headings that we've got. That top one there, it's a regular one we do, Project Sense and Top Stories, which look at the unreported stories around the world. And there are quite a few of them. And one of those unreported stories, of course, is thorium, which is the alternative for uranium in nuclear power stations. Why was uranium chosen over thorium, which is more plentiful and nowhere near as dangerous? Because it doesn't produce nuclear bombs, which is what uranium does. It produces plutonium, which produces bombs. And that's why uranium was chosen 60 years ago in Chicago as the fuel for nuclear reactors. Anyway, we're not here to talk about nuclear reactors. We're here to talk about Egypt, ancient Egypt, and the lost technology of ancient Egypt. Very familiar place. This is not the Great Pyramid, this is the Middle Pyramid. The Great Pyramid is on the right, but when you take a picture of the Sphinx in front of the pyramid, that's the one you get. It's the one with the little top. Now, there's one question when I was in Egypt that I couldn't get answered, to do with the granite of Egypt. How was it cut? How was the granite cut? How was it removed from the bedrock? How was it carved? How was it shaped, smoothed, and inscribed with hieroglyphs? And how was it carried? How was it removed from the Aswan quarry and placed into position? Aswan is about 400 miles south of Giza, about 200 miles south of Luxor. It could have been floated down the river, but we're talking about things that weigh 50 odd tons each. Now, if you ask an Egyptologist to explain that, how the granite was cut, carved and carried, they will say that it was cut and shaped using diorite pounding balls. Diorite is a very hard form of granite-type material. We'll see one later. It was carved using flint and copper chisels, which is a ridiculous thing to say, because flint, though it is very, can be very sharp, is very brittle and will easily fracture. Copper is a soft metal and there's no way it can cut granite. But those are the only explanations that one is offered. And granite is carried by putting 300 ton obelisks on wooden rollers and hauling 70 ton blocks up ramps. That is the explanation. This is how Egyptologists, those who study the subject, explain what is going on. I don't think that's a good answer. I don't think it's any sort of answer. So what do the myths and legends, the oral histories, tell us? They say that rocks, the rock softening liquid, is known about. There is stones that melt. That is referred to quite regularly. And there is something called a rock softening liquid. It is known about in South America. It is known about to this day in South America. It's been reported on several occasions. And it is something which has been observed. There's a bird in South America called the Andean flicker, which is about the size of a small pigeon or a woodpecker, that makes its nest in rock faces. And it makes a nest by taking a leaf, rubbing it against the rock face, dropping the leaf, pecking away at the rock face, and continuing that process until it has a hole big enough to nest in. So the rock softening liquid is made from plants which do exist. I've never been able to find any, but it doesn't mean to say that it doesn't exist. Stones that float, this is quite often discussed, referred to in the oral history and the mythology, there are stones that float. It's this harmonic or acoustic levitation. And is there evidence of saws, drills and lathes in Egypt which imply machine tools which in turn imply a form of energy to drive them? We'll have a look at some of the evidence for that shortly. In the meantime, let's have a look at Egypt and the familiar pyramids. The Great Pyramid is the one in the foreground here. That was the one we just seen, and that is the smaller one to feature towards the end. This is the tourist view of Egypt, and a very familiar view, as is this. They're very beautiful things. They're huge, they're vast. And one could always ask the question, well, how were they built? How were they constructed? Because they're basically completely without flaws in them. This is the Great Pyramid here. Now, that is something. Most people will say, if you ask about the Great Pyramid, oh, it's a four-sided pyramid. Or five, if you count the base. But it's not. It's an eight-sided pyramid. Each side is split. And though it is possible, if you know what to look for, to see that that is not a flat surface. Notice it's different here. This is a satellite photograph, looking straight down, and the sun at a particular angle, you can actually see that there is a dividing line down it. Now, if you measure across the Great Pyramid here, it's 750 feet along each side, 480 foot high, and if you measure it, there is an indentation of 4 feet on each face. When you look at the pyramid, it doesn't appear to have that indentation, unless you know what to look for or when to see it. It was first noticed from an aerial photograph taken in 1935, and it is quite obvious that if you take it at a certain time, with the light skimming the surface, the face is obvious. Now, you'll notice that they are not the same. This is the middle pyramid, and the Sphinx is down here. The Sphinx is actually really quite small relative to the pyramid. I spent a little while in Egypt, about 10 years ago, and I was aware that if I caught the sun at the precisely correct angle, this is in March, which is the spring solstice. This is the north face of the Great Pyramid. The sun is setting to the west over here, and as it skimmed the surface, you'll notice that one face is illuminated and the other face isn't. Now that implies an incredible level of technology, that they can not only build something like that, but do four faces of the pyramid. It's very hard to build a pyramid, to get the line, the stones lined up so that the angles are correct. Very, very difficult to do, which is why we don't build them too often nowadays. Now, inside the Great Pyramid, we have the King's Chamber, so called because it has a flat roof. The Queen's Chamber has a gabled roof, and in Muslim countries, men bury it in tombs with a flat roof, and women in tombs with a gabled roof. Hence the King's Chamber. Inside it is this object, referred to as the sarcophagus, implying it was a coffin of some sort. Nobody has ever been found in it, there's no hieroglyph, there's no indication at all that it was used for anything. There's no indication at all. There's one point about this box, we'll call it. It's made of one piece of granite. It's not five pieces but put together. It's one piece of granite, big enough to lie down in, and the faces are completely flat, mirror flat. There is evidence of drills on them, and there's evidence of saws on the outside. There's only one entrance into the King's Chamber. It's down here on the right-hand side. And this box is too big to go through that entrance, implying that the pyramid was built around it. This point here is 150 foot above ground level. Above this box, here it is here, there are five layers of granite beams. There they are. Five layers of them. And we're told it's to relieve the weight of the pyramid above it. It's 200-300 foot of stonework above it. I don't quite know why you need to relieve it in this fashion. Why wouldn't one be adequate? Anyway, These beams, you can see, they're quite wide, they're 19 foot wide. They weigh, on average, 40 tons each. And there's 45 of them. There's 9 in each layer. They came from Aswan, 400 miles south. They were raised 150 foot into the air, or in this case, 180 foot into the air, the height of Nelson's Column. 50 ton blocks of granite. Now, it would be possible to do that today, to raise a 50 ton block of granite 180 foot into the air. But you would need the sort of crane, the sort of lifting device that would require a team of probably 30 people to do it. It would take about 3 weeks to erect the crane in place, and it couldn't move. Once it's there, it could lift it, but it couldn't, the crane then couldn't move. If you're going to put these beams in place, with the pyramid at the point built around it, you would need to be able to reach over about 300 foot from the point you raise the block. You then need to move it across about 300 foot to get the position. That is what's difficult to do, not the lifting of the block. How it was built, nobody has yet come up with a decent answer. Nobody has yet been able to explain what it's for, or even who built it. It is said it was a tomb of some pharaoh called Khafre, or Cheops in this case, in the case of the Great Pyramid, whose portrait is supposed to be that of the Sphinx. There's no indication that is correct at all. If you ask the Kemetians, Kemetian, Kemet is the name that Egypt calls itself, the Egyptians call itself. Egypt is a Greek word. It was adopted at the time of the Greeks invaded Egypt in about 300, and Alexander the Great about 300 BC. And they were told what they wanted the Greeks to hear. If you ask people who have grown up as Egyptians without the influence of external forces, they will tell you that nobody knows who built these pyramids, but they're at least 25,000 years old, if not older. Here's our friend the Sphinx, pyramid, the Great Pyramid over here. And you'll notice that the Sphinx enclosure has been hollowed out. That is the surface, that's the desert surface. This is sandstone here and floor of the Sphinx enclosure. We'll have a look in a minute at where they put the stone they removed from the Sphinx enclosure. And this is there's an example here of the water erosion that has given rise to the redating of the Sphinx and in turn the pyramids. Because water erosion occurs vertically, wind erosion occurs horizontally. But for most of the recorded time that the Sphinx has been known about, which is about 4,000 years, the Sphinx enclosure has been buried in sand. It's only in the last 150 years that it's actually been excavated. So that people actually knew the Sphinx was a little bit more than just a lump of rock stuck above the surface. They didn't know the enclosure was there. Next to the enclosure, next to the Sphinx, is where they put what was excavated from the Sphinx enclosure. These are the sandstone lumps of material that were taken out. They weigh about 80 to 100 tons each, and then just piled up one on top of the other, as if they're Lego. This is the outside of what is referred to as the Valley Temple. There are two temples in front of the Sphinx. One is the Valley Temple, which is this one, which tourists go into, and the other one directly in front of the Sphinx is called the Sphinx Temple, which nobody goes into. I don't know why, but they don't. And then it's just lying on the ground, minding its own business, doing nothing, is this. What is it? It's granite. It appears to have been an architrave that has fallen off the top here, but that's a guess. But it's a piece of granite. We'll look at it in more detail later, but this is a very, very finely worked piece of stone. But worked by who and for what purpose? We'll come back to that in a minute. This is now inside the Valley Temple. And you notice this is the other side of the blocks we looked at, and it's lined with granite. Wherever you get granite in Egypt, it comes from Aswan. It's the only place you can get granite. And notice that some of these blocks here are shaped really quite elegantly. It's as if, you know, if we're going to build something with blocks of granite, you take a block and you stick it on top of another one, and if it doesn't fit, you get one that does. You don't cut a little piece out of one so that the block will fit. Maybe you'll cut it there. But in Egypt, no, it was much easier to just do that. And then when you get a corner piece here, you make it L-shaped, because that's the easiest thing to do. That's the way it's done. Looking at the lining, this is the inside, this is the granite lining, and you'll notice that the granite block here has been cut around the sandstone. That makes no sense at all. Sandstone is a much softer material than granite. The only thing that cuts granite today easily are diamonds. You have to have a harder material to cut soft material. Why was it so simple to cut or to shape the granite block around the sandstone? Another bit there. Because it was easy to do. So what material could have been used to do that? And I would offer the rock softening liquid as a possible solution. Because it's not something easily whacked with a lump of stone. That's how the traditional explanations of it. Here is this piece of granite again that we looked at outside. You notice it's got curves on it. And these, if you put a steel rod across here, it's completely flat. It is not something which is just roughly carved. Another piece just lying on the ground. Huge curve here and three angle point here. It's weird. It's almost inexplicable as to how something like that can be done. Anyway, we'll go down here, go down from Giza down to Aswan. That's Duncan, who's the editor of Nexus. He was on the trip along with a couple of other people you may have heard of. This is the unfinished obelisk. Unfinished because it's obelisk shaped, pointy top. Long thin body, but it got cracked, so it got left in the ground. And you could walk all over it, it's granite, it wouldn't do any damage. A lot of people come to it, it's worth a visit, it's an interesting place to go to. When I was there, I noticed something. These marks here, they appear all over. That's the same mark we just looked at now, and this is the other side of it. And these are regular excavations on this, or regular marks. This is what we're looking at here is where an obelisk has been removed from the quarry. So it's been undercut by some means on either side, it's been undercut, and when a thin strip of granite was left, it was just pushed and it broke because it's granite by brittle and it was taken away. But this is what it looks like underneath. This is the undercut of an obelisk. And you're being asked to believe that this was achieved with pounding diorite balls. You have to lie almost on your back and pound away aside like that to do it if you're doing it with a pounding diorite ball. It looks more like ice cream scoops. It looks as if the granite has been softened in some way and then scooped out, which would be a much more logical way of doing it if you had something that would soften the rock. This is what the unfinished obelisk looks like, the trench around it. It's about 40 metres long, and in the trench, this is the trench here, there's the same hole, it's got these same marks all over the bottom, as if there was a scoop. This is the side of it here. And this is the unfinished obelisk at the top, where you get a more clear view of these indentations. This is the side where it appears to have been scooped out. I don't know. I mean, I say scooped because that's what it looks like, but it doesn't look as if it was achieved by hitting it with this, which is the diorite pounding ball explanation.
So what's the official explanation for those markings? Are they just ignored?
I've never seen anybody discuss them, other than to say that Well, it was removed with a diorite pounding board, this sort of thing. And to be fair, around the unfinished obelisk there are an awful lot of these lying around. There may be another explanation for them, which we're going to in a minute. But this is the official explanation. I was in Egypt. I did ask about those marks. I said, well, what would make those marks? Oh, the pounding diorite ones. That was all. So, these are also created by pounding diorite balls, obviously, because it's the only thing that could carve granite. This is Hatshepsut's obelisk at Karnak, at Luxor, and this is the Luxor temple. Beautifully carved. And of course, you can't make a mistake. You know, if you get the bird around the wrong way, you can't start, run it out and start again. You have to get another obelisk from Astron, so you can get it right. And these beautiful statues, they're bigger than life size. The one in the British Museum, one in the Cairo Museum, and one in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. But they're highly prized because they're extremely beautiful sculptures, made of course with pounding diorite balls and copper chisels. But if you measure them, if you get a head-on view, they are actually mirror, if you split it down the middle, they're mirror images. Each side is a mirror image as well. It's as if they've been made by machine. In the Luxor Museum is this example, which I think is one of the most remarkable pieces of granite sculpture I've ever seen. Now, you ask any sculpture today, would you work in granite? And I say, not if I can help it, I work in sandstone or limestone. Because sandstone is a very easy material to work in. Limestone traditionally is the material for sculpture. Michelangelo's sculpture of David in Florence is made of limestone, made of marble. And from the Carrera quarries in Italy, this is a piece of marble. They're all, most rock weighs about the same. Now this is a cubic foot, this box. Oh no, I made it. A cubic foot. If it was rock, it would weigh more than I would. About 180 pounds. If it's water, it would weigh 62 pounds. So rock is quite heavy, difficult to move. This head here, that is very nearly the size it is in real life. So it's a big piece of granite. And then you start seeing these other sculptures here. Bear in mind, these are all at least 4,000 years old if we follow the traditional dating, or older if we don't. But no tools existed at that time that we are aware of that would cut this sort of hard igneous rock, which is volcanic type rock. This is probably one of the most spectacular sculptures in the Cairo Museum. It's of the Pharaoh Khafre, we're told, being protected by Horus. When you look at him face on, you actually can't see Horus behind him, he's protecting him. This is a life-size cow, goddess Hathor, again made out of a very, very hard material. These are made out of granite. This is Horus here, protecting the god of life, Anubis, the god of death, protecting the pharaoh. This is one piece of granite, bigger than life size. And I don't fancy, really, one's chances of a pounding diorite ball doing anything but knocking that little nose off, or these ears. They are extremely beautiful. They're very well made. They're not representational. They're symbolic sculptures. You know what you're looking at when you see them. In the Cairo Museum is this diorite Benban stone, top of the pyramid, carved extremely accurately using, I don't know what. The only thing that would do that nowadays would be diamond. We don't have diamond in Egypt. They could work gold, but gold was well known. This is the back of Tutankhamun's death mask. We all know what the front looks like, but not many people know what the back looks like, so it's not the back.
Andy!
This is David Hatchett-Childress, who is the owner of Adventures Unlimited Press in America. And he insisted on standing there, so take my picture with the boomerangs. These all came out of Tutankhamun's tomb. Where did they come from? Now you ask anybody, where do boomerangs come from? They'll tell you, well, it comes from Australia, of course. Obviously, it's the only place that we know that had them. They're known as throwing sticks in other places, but the implication being that Tutankhamun had lived about 1350 BC. The implication being that somebody went to Australia, saw them, and came back. And said, look, if we make a stick like this and throw it, it'll come back. Great, and chase after it. So did they sail to Australia? Could the Egyptians have sailed to Australia? Well, the answer is yes, they could. They did. Now, if you look at any, if you look at Google Maps now, and you look at the top end of the Nile, you'll find there's a canal linking the Nile to the Red Sea. It's called the Sweetwater Canal. It's still there today. It's still used today. It links the Red Sea. So you could sail from the Nile through the Sweetwater Canal into the Red Sea. And if you then went to Australia, the longest stretch of open water you would have to sail across is 70 miles between New Guinea and Australia, if you work on the coast. So it wasn't a big deal to sail. They had boats that could do it. And if you look at some of the historical record, the Noahs were sailing to North America about 2000 BC, so they were well capable of doing it. These are the boats they use today, very nice. This is the Hatshepsut Temple. If you remember, about 15 years ago, there was a massacre of some tourists in Egypt, and that's where it happened. It's an unfortunate experience for whoever was there. The other side here, this is the Valley of the Kings, where all the famous burials are. But you'll see that the Nile, this is at Luxor, which is about 200 miles south of Giza. That's basically the width of the cultivated land on either side. Very few people know of this place. Very few people have heard of this place. The Osirian at Abydos. Abydos is about a 2-hour drive north of Luxor. And this place, it was only discovered by Flinders Petrie, who was possibly the best Egyptologist in the 19th century, because he spotted a dip on the ground and thought, oh, what's there? It's called the Osirian, not because anybody knows that Osiris had anything to do with it, but it's supposed to be the last resting place of the god Osiris. It appears unfinished. It appears to be damaged quite severely. These are all granite blocks, they're about 80 tons, 100 tons each. A square cut, placed up on top of each other, obviously quite easy if you just went back this way. You notice that there's even mortise and tenon cuts to make sure the things stay together. The people who built this knew what they were doing. They knew how to manipulate granite. Here's a real mystery. Why is this door this particular height? There was obviously a reason for it. And if you're going to make a door of a particular height, wouldn't it be simpler to just find enough blocks to build it up to that height and then put the lintel across the top? No, it was simpler to build any old house and then cut the lintel. Not once, three times. Visible, there's actually seven of them all together. Why did they do that? And when you've got a little lump taken out of your granite here, you just cut a little piece into it. That's a simple way to do it. This is the end door, and it's again that the lintel has not been moved up, it's been cut and it's been shaped. And then we start noticing these things here, these knobs, that appear to serve no purpose whatsoever. That I found. If anybody has any suggestions as to what they might be, I'd love to hear it, because they appear, as we'll see, around the world. Of course, if you're going to go around the world, it's nice to have a helicopter to do it, and this is a famous helicopter hiring.
Yes.
It's not any old helicopter, it's a helicopter that lifts large, heavy weights. Russians have them today. This is obviously a tank, this is a UFO, setting. It's virtually invisible from ground level. If you know where to look, you can see it, and if you've got a camera that you can stick on a tripod, you can get a reasonable picture of it. The official explanation is it's a palimpsest. A palimpsest is something which started life as one thing, was altered, because these, especially plaster that is used, and bits fell off and exposed some of the underneath bit with the top bit still there. To be honest, I can't see that. I can't see that as a logical explanation. It looks more like it's a helicopter, it's a tank, it's a UFO, it's a glider. But of course you can't say that if you're talking to a geologist, because they get rather upset. However, let's go to London and see some more things which geologists can't explain. This is in the Petrie Museum in London, just on top of Brook Road. This is quite famous, this piece of rock here, called Core Number 7. It was collected by Flinders Petrie in 1884 from Giza. It's about 2 inches in diameter, 7 inches long, and it has grooves right the way along it. They're not circles, they're spirals. I know it's a spiral. I took a piece of cotton with me, and I took that photograph and wound it around. And it follows one continuous loop. This is similar. Again, granite. How on earth do you drill something like that with a copper chisel? This was again found in Giza, obviously being discarded because it is obviously got it off centre. So they've chucked it away and drilled it again. But it's drilled right the way through the middle. A piece of granite that has been cut, this is the way you would traditionally remove large pieces of material from, or you would cut lines across it and just knock them out. And then in the Cairo Museum, there's this strange piece of granite. In real life, it's about the size of a grapefruit, half a grapefruit. But it's been hollowed out by being drilled. There are drill marks here, and these are quite evidently drill marks. It's the sort of drill mark you'll get if you're drilling a piece of wood with a circular drill. And it was just lying around, it's been discarded, obviously it wasn't finished because it was going to be a bulb, but we can get around to building it. And this is how, we're told, they did it all. Copper chisels, pounding diorite rocks. But copper is not strong enough to cut granite under any circumstances. Bronze is hardly strong enough. As far as we know, bronze wasn't known in Egypt until about 1000 BC. Because bronze is made by a simple expedient of taking copper ore and adding 10% tin. The tin and copper don't occur very close together. Tin is normally in England, that's where Cornwall comes in, and copper in North America, also right across the Mediterranean. But these are not explanations that would be acceptable. This is Avebury, and these, we just have a look around at a few other places before we get to South America, just to demonstrate the moving of large rocks was obviously easy to do. Stonehenge. Karnak, this is a 300-ton Grand Menhir that fell over and broke. 60-ton block, Dolmen, one in Germany, one in Spain. Greece has quite a lot of almost pyramid-shaped things. Malta, large stones being moved around quite easily. And in Turkey, not many people even heard of this place. The excavation is cutting, it was only discovered in 1995 when a local shepherd tripped over the top of one of these. And there's 25 similar enclosures like this. They're known about, they haven't been excavated, only about 5 have been excavated. But they're very beautifully carved. They're obviously there deliberately. It's quite an isolated part of Turkey, but it's been dated quite conclusively to 9500 BC, i.e. the earliest archaeological site ever discovered to date. Yeah, the excavation is still going on. But it puts back, it's as far from Stonehenge as we are, in terms of time. In Morocco, Lixus, this is the Lixus River, it flows down through Morocco into the Atlantic, and this megalithic wall still exists today. And it is mentioned as a place where the Phoenicians, people who used to live in what we now call Lebanon, the Phoenicians sailed from there to South America. Because that's the obvious place you go to South America from. You pick up the current and the winds and away you go. And do you know there's Stonehenge in Libya? It's just near Tripoli. And this is why the country is called Zimbabwe. It's named after this remarkable structure created, nobody knows when. The British managed to wreck it pretty comprehensively when they were there. And they couldn't believe the locals might have been able to build something like that. Then we come to Jerusalem, the famous Western Wall, the Wailing Wall. And this is what the wall looks like close up, just along here. They are large, well-dressed, well-cut blocks of sandstone. Now, going through that arch there, the wall continues about another 1,000 feet. This is all fairly recent construction. The Temple of Jerusalem was built about 1,000 BC. And in the tunnel, this is what you get, the extension of the wall. And the big block in there is about 500 tons. These holes in it were later additions so that somebody could plaster the thing. That got taken off very rapidly. Then we come to Baalbek and the trilithon, the 800 ton blocks here, 20 foot up in the air. Compared to the person there, they are big, large, fucking great lumps of rock. And here is the block that is still in the quarry. There's the Temple of Baalbek, just about a mile away. This block is meant to weigh about 1,200 tons. It's been cut from the quarry, it's been dressed, it has been moved. But if you ask somebody, what is the largest stone ever moved by man? Most people will say that one, because it has been moved. Now, the largest stone ever moved by man that is known about is this one. It is the plinth here. That's known as the Thunderstone. That's there today. The bronze horseman, so-called, because he's made bronze, obviously, it actually represents Peter the Great, Tsar of Russia. And this was put together by Catherine the Great, who succeeded him. And the Thunderstone, here's the Thunderstone, it was so-called because it was alleged to have been knocked from a mountain in Finland by lightning during a thunderstorm. It was being moved from Finland to St. Petersburg, which isn't as far as it sounds. It's about 10 miles across the Gulf of Finland. But they had to get it across Finland, about 4 miles across down to the coast where they couldn't come to a ship. But look at the way it's being moved on cannonballs, which is the obvious way to do it, when you think about it. Rollers made of wood would get crushed. This is 1,500 tons. It's being worked on as it is being moved. It took about 9 months to move that distance because they had to wait for the ground to freeze so things didn't fall into it. But it's being moved on in channels on cannonballs. Where have we seen something like that before? The unfinished old list?
Yes.
The Deerite pounding balls?
No.
Could they be the method that was used to move the obelisks? It's quite possible that it was. There's no record of it. And it would be quite a turn up. The thing to look for would be these channels. Now they could have been readapted instead of being channels for balls to roll in.
Wouldn't work on sand though, would it? Cannonballs wouldn't work on sand, would they?
No, it wouldn't. That's why you would need that sort of channel made of stone for them to roll in. And obviously you don't need a very long, because as soon as it gets to the end, you take them up, you bring them out the front. You wouldn't need many of them. You probably wouldn't need that many cannonballs in this case. And you could probably calculate the pressure on it. But that is one particular way that they could be moved, which rather puts the idea of acoustic levitation to one side for the moment. But that may well be something else that has been explored. But that is the brute force method of moving. Just to give an indication that all around the world there are stone circles. This is in Kashmir, in India. There are standing stones in India. There are even standing stones being erected 100 years ago in Indonesia. The famous plain jars in Laos, nobody knows what they're about. They're huge, well made. This is a 60-ton dolmen in Korea. This is a tomb in Japan. And then we come to the underwater stuff, Yonaguni. This is a photograph taken of this. This is a model of the whole structure. This particular piece here, it's about this section here, and the steps. It's not a direct representation. But this is known to exist. And I just include this picture here. This is Okinawa, which is very close to Yonaguni. Yonaguni is the southern part. Japan, it comes down in a string of islands down towards Taiwan. Okinawa is where the American Air Force or American naval base is. And there are structures there today above the sea which appear to be very similar in appearance to what is underwater, about 50 foot underwater here. Nan Madol in Micronesia. Micronesia is north of New Guinea, south of Japan. It's technically it's called the Federated States of Micronesia. It's a collection of islands. It used to be called the Gilbert Nellis Islands when British Dominion, British Empire was in charge of it. But this strange structure here is on. That's one of the islands. Namadol is actually just one of the islands. This structure is made of basalt columns, similar to the ones that, if you go to the north coast of Ireland, Giant's Causeway is made of very constructed. Well, not, Giant's Causeway is not constructed, it's a natural formation. These are naturally occurring basalt material which have been moved quite some distance. And they're quite big. Some of them might be 50 tons, but they could move them and lift them and put them in place with no apparent difficulty. What was going on? The story about how they were moved, the local legend says they were flown. They were floated, not on the water, but through the air. Who by? Nobody knows. Why? Nobody knows. When? Nobody knows. And it's just, you can visit it, but it's, there's not much there. Easter Island, similar, unexplained. These are big lumps of volcanic rock. Here's one that's the bit out above the ground. There's a lot of bit below ground as well. They're huge. And Easter Island is not that big. It's about the size of the Isle of Wight. Not that particularly large. They're cut out of the bedrock. There's one that's being cut out. It got as far as being cut, but it never got moved. Another one there. But obviously it could be done easily. On Easter Island, there's this strange wall. Where have we seen this type of structure before? We've seen it all over the world. And we see it again here in South America, Machu Picchu, famous place, well-known place, and we're starting to see these little knobs here that are occurring around Machu Picchu itself, in Cusco, all over the place. And what's this? Having a laugh here. Mm-hmm. Maybe this was an apprentice's finishing piece. You have to cut 15 corners into one piece of stone and just fit it. It's easy to do it, otherwise they wouldn't bother. Or that's our way of thinking. We do things because they're easy to do. They did it, maybe for the same reason, but maybe because they had the skills or the ability or the technique, the technology to do it very differently. And then correctly, a sexy woman, because it's very hard to pronounce that. These are very large lumps of, they're called andesite in South America, it's the same as granite in Europe. They're big. These marks we saw in Egypt. This one looked almost like forklift truck marks on the rock. And these indentations here, we saw those in Egypt as well. So we're seeing a technology which appears to have connections between Africa and South America, but they're a long, long way apart, separated by a rather large ocean. I think, I've got no idea what this is. It may be the apprentice's proving ground. Right, then build some steps. All right, I'll build some more, and I'll build a really big one. They don't go anywhere, they don't do anything. These steps don't go anywhere. There's the walls we were looking at just before. And these marks here are very similar to the ones we see in Egypt. Is it that different continents acquire the same technology at a similar time, a different time, or is there a link between them? On Te Tabo, up very high up, these are about 20 foot high, and they came from the other side of the valley, from a quarry, where you have to cross a fairly large river to get these lumps of, so they're six separated by different pieces there. But again, these knobs appearing regularly. Incredible skill to produce something like that out of, in effect, granite. There's the knobs again. You see them. No two stones on here are the same, which would imply that they were carved in place. I was about to say cast, because it does look like that some of them are cast. And there is a strong argument which will say that the pyramids and many of the structures were made from geopolymers, i.e. cast stone. And the evidence for it is fairly persuasive. But if you're going to cast stone, are you going to make stone structures? You make it out of one form, one basic shape. You don't make lots and lots and lots of different shapes and then cast them. So I don't think that the casting idea works here. It doesn't work here either, because these don't appear to be similar shapes or sizes. Some of them may well be. Moving up to Lake Titicaca, which is 12,000 foot above sea level, you get this extraordinary place, Tiwanaku. It has been dated using astroarchaeology, which is the use of star positions relative to the Earth, to determine the date. And it's been dated at 15,000 BC. But this is very different type of architecture and very different type of carving to what we saw down in Peru, which is about 500 miles away. This is angular. It appears to have some sort of lettering on it. This is meant to represent their culture. There's the god of the original inhabitants there. Here he is again. This is the gateway of the sun at Tiwanaku. And you notice the straight edges, the accurate carving. It actually fell over, it broke, that's why it was that mark there, and it's been re-erected. Weighs quite a lot, and again it's made of andesite. And then we come to the really extraordinary, inexplicable, totally bizarre place. It's not far from Tiwanaku, but Pumapunku. These large, fairly large blocks, some of them up to 100 tons, just lying around. But if you start looking at the detail, look at the way it's been carved. Look at how some of this carving here. is not only extremely accurate, it's very delicately done. These holes here are about 6 millimeters in diameter. And the line down here is absolutely straight. You look down one end of it and see straight through the other. Why would you want to do something like this in what looks like a block of concrete?
It does, it's very modern.
Yeah, the older in time we get, the more modern the appearance of enough. I mean, this could be a piece of cast concrete today.
Mm.
It's not, it's a carved andesite. And this is, it's known as the fort. I don't quite know why it's known as the fort. It's, I get about 500 miles from there, but I only include it because this is to demonstrate how clever Eric von Däniken was. He said this was possibly a UFO landing site. And everybody said, oh, he was so stupid or a ridiculous thing to say. He just happened to have a book that he was publicising at the time, so they all rushed out and bought the book to prove him wrong. He's now sold 65 million copies of his books because he didn't say that the NASCAR lines were UFO, anything to do with UFOs. He said they could be seen from space, which might imply that somebody had the ability to fly, which was interpreted as being a UFO, obviously. So, I don't think Eric von Däniken really cared too much for being precise. And then, again, near Lake Titicaca, Amaru Meru, quite extraordinary. This is the Stargate. This is the Stargate. And this is bedrock. That's a mountain, that's part of the mountain. This has been cut out, shaped, for some reason, nobody knows why, nobody knows who did it, nobody knows when it was done. But I looked at that and I thought, hey, I've seen that before. I've seen that cutting out like this. I've seen it before. It's in Egypt. This is the entrance to the smaller of the three pyramids. These are granite blocks lining the lower levels of the third pyramid. Why would you need to do that? Why would you need to cut here to make a very flat surface? None of the others. Notice the knobs here, by the way, which occur all over, which have no known purpose. And yet this has been shaped. It wouldn't appear to be a reason to do so. It makes no logical sense at all to have done it. But all we can say for certain is it has been done and it does exist. So where does that lead us? What is the technology of ancient Egypt? I would say that yes, some of it we do know about. Some of the technology is quite evident, but a lot of it is not. There are a lot of explanations offered, which are explanations trying to account for what is seen. When you get something 450 foot high, and the Great Pyramid is slightly higher, but on a slightly big, higher piece of ground, was the biggest building, the tallest building in the world until the Eiffel Tower was built in 1880. So somebody had the ability to do something we've only just in the last 155 years had the ability to do. It's a technology, where it comes from, why it exists. I suspect we will find out, and I think the answer is going to be not taking the existing paradigm and saying, well, it's just a bunch of guys who wanted to bury their pharaohs and they built a big tomb for it. Because that is the Western view of what is seen. The Western view is that if it's a big, unexplained building, it's a tomb. If it's a very spectacular building, it's a temple. Because that obviously parallels what we see as a church. If we stop looking at it like that and start looking at it from a purely engineering point of view, how would you achieve it? Now, I mentioned the rock softening liquid that it is known about today. It comes from South America. It's made of plants. If you recall, there is a story of the poison tip arrows, which is tipped with curare. Curare is an extract of the plant. And interesting enough, curare is still used today as an anesthetic because it's a muscle relaxant. So when you go to hospital, I generally said, if you're a candidate, you've got curare on there, the artificial version of it. But if you think of somebody making up a paste of curare, because that's what they are, and they put the arrow head into it, and they fire it into the monkey, and the tree, and the monkey drops out, because it can't hang on, it's a muscle relaxant, and then they rush over and grab him, and that's lunch. And somebody had the bright idea of asking the shamans here in South America, if I eat the monkey that's just been shot with the arrow and he's got a monkey and he's got all this in his body, how come if I eat it, I don't get the same problem? Why don't my muscles relax so I can't breathe? And they say, when you shoot with the arrow, it enters the bloodstream. When you eat the meat, it enters the stomach. In the stomach, there are certain enzymes which neutralize the active ingredient that enters the bloodstream that causes muscle relaxation. And they said, how do you know that? Was it trial and error? And how many people died before you found out the right plant to use? No. We asked the plants. We asked the plants. The shaman can do that. The use of ayahuasca is known to allow communication across the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom. If you have that ability to acquire that knowledge, you, as a shaman, this is why shamans and religious leaders in the old days were so highly revered, because they actually risk their lives on a regular basis to acquire knowledge. And why the technology behind it was so fiercely guarded. Not because it was a one-off, you know, I know about it and you don't, so there, and I'm not going to. No, because it was extremely dangerous to have that knowledge. If you got the wrong plants, you died. If you had too much of it, the wrong proportions, you died. The priests, the shamans, the religious leaders, they were the people who risked their lives to acquire the knowledge, and they were revered because the knowledge that came back was of value, such as which plants to use in the poison of arrows. The rock softening liquid, I reckon, is the same. We've lost the technology, but to approach the right shaman in South America with the right question may well come up with the right answer. And I would love to be able to produce a bottle and say, here is the rock softening liquid, and produce a piece of granite, pour one onto the other, and bring this clay like. One day, that's what we'll do. So my thanks and acknowledgements are due to Eric von Däniken, who mentioned he started the journey for me and probably for many others. Graham Hancock, who has written very well and for a long time and endured a lot of criticism. Christopher Dunn, for his engineering skills, he was the man who identified the Great Pyramid as a power plant. Read his book, too long to explain. David Childress, we've met him, he's published a great deal of material on this subject. Robert Temple, he was the person who identified the Stonehenge in Libya, the Lyxus wall, and the picture of the Third Pyramid. And Martin Gray, whose photographs I used for Egypt, and Stonehenge, and Avebury, and various other sites, he spent his life photographing the sacred sites of the world. Check out his website, sacredsites.com. So then we come back to the beginning. Those who haven't seen Nexus, you've got a treat in store, and they're all over there. Four of them for £10, one for £4, and your life will never be quite the same again. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.